number one fan has just listened to the second time of Skylark of Space. Thank you so very much.
Go tape.
Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
We'll pick up the countdown shortly here in H-minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
Okay, sorry about that, folks. A little bit of a technical error on my part. So let's see. First order of business today. A letter. Yes, a letter. From whom? From SDFer Eskill, whom you may remember as the person who contributed a piece of art which I used as the logo for last year's A Step Farther Out Master Post. And what does Eskill have to say? This is dated the 1st of February. It says, hello again, thanks for the postcard. I always appreciate your stamps and fine choice in stationery. I should explain, I'd sent out a bunch of postcards to folks who had expressed interest in my nuclear energy-related communications in previously. These were based on, I think I mentioned, sheets of postcards at letter size that were produced by the post office back in 1989. They were specifically designed to be run through office printers, and that's exactly what I did with them. Printed a return address cachet on the side of the postage. I hand wrote in the addresses, that was easier, and then affixed the additional postage, needed to bring it up to the new rate, and then on the other side I had printed the I printed a little message and also affixed one of my stickers. Anyway, if you still have copies of Blast, I'd be honored if you'd send one my way. I let a few of my friends know about you and your cause, so I hope you will receive their letters sometime soon. I know you didn't ask for any payment, and I'm not sure if it goes against the philosophy of zines, but I included something for the resources and your troubles. Thanks again. Looking forward to your response. Eskill. And so I did. I sent a sample copy of Blast. In fact, I think it was one of my working drafts. I print them off five at a time, whatever the current version is, and then one of them winds up getting marked up by me as I'm reading through it and deciding what to do with it. So I think he probably got one of those. And yes, that is a thing that can happen to you, along with some leaflets and stickers to distribute to the aforementioned friends. And yes, I do hope that I hear from his school friends. We'll find out. Today's mail, however, was something more exciting because it gives me a chance to make one of my patented megalomaniacal statements. One of those things that I can say that sounds, you know, like just no end of nonsense, but is actually true. In this case, it's, I've just had returned from Sandia National Laboratory some materials which I lent them for research purposes. Now, if you know what Sandia National Laboratory does, their main job is designing triggers for thermonuclear weapons. So it might cause you to wonder just exactly what kind of materials has he been sending them for research purposes? That sounds very scary. That is in the same general vein as my comment. How do you arrest someone for violating the Atomic Energy Act of 1946, which bans private ownership of nuclear weapons? It's like, is the FBI going to come knock on your door and say, you're under arrest for... No, I mean, they're not going to do that, right? Anyway, but no, in this particular case, as I mentioned previously on this show, Dr. Ron Neef, who lately retired from Sandia, had borrowed from me, or I had lent to him, depending how you see it, some nuclear reactor charts I had acquired. And now that I have them back, I can mount them and use them for display purposes, which was my whole purpose for them. But Dr. Neef had been involved, had initiated some years ago a project to scan as many of these charts as possible in order to make them available to the interested public through the University of New Mexico's Engineering Library. Now, Gemlog, that is absolute slander. That is absolute slander. Everybody knows I pay union scale for all my minions and henchmen. I respect the collective bargaining rights of the International Minions and Henchmen's Union. So on the way here, on the way home, that is to say, from the post office, because of course I had to go to the post office to pick up the mail from my mailbox, on the way home I stopped at a Greasy Spoon for breakfast, and one of the things that struck me was the large side-by-side, or rather side-by-side-by-side refrigerator, three doors, each with a large glass window, that they had just behind the bar, which was a Frigidaire made only by General Motors. Now, this appliance must have been 70 years old. And it gives the impression, looking at it, that it will probably continue running not only into the next century, but probably into the next millennium. Not energy efficient by today's standards, but then today's standards only expect pieces of equipment like that to run for something like 10 years. So for every 10 years it runs, it saves the energy of manufacturing a whole new one. And this leads me into something that I mean to say, right, something I plan to talk about, which is nice. And what I mean to talk about, well, the myth of the Golden Age. You see, it's very, very easy for people to get caught in a kind of intellectual trap where they imagine that there was some time and or place where everything was right, everything was good, everything was just, everything was peachy keen. And that is a dangerous delusion. And the rejection of it is also a dangerous delusion. What do I mean? Well, for example, one of the things that people have a tendency to idealize, to imagine as a golden age, right? Well, you could talk about classical Athens, which we think of in a very important way intellectually, right? Our intellectual tradition, our philosophy, our habits of thinking about thought are very much tied up with classical Athens. In many ways, the intellectual milieu of classical Athens represents where all this modern science and so on comes from. So it'd be very easy to cast that as a golden age. And yet, classical Athens was very much a slave society. It was a society in which only a tiny fraction of the actual population were citizens with full rights, that the bulk of the population was metics and slaves, and metics who were free people but who did not have full rights of citizenship. And of course, you know, women had no voice in the society whatsoever, and a great deal of the prosperity of society was founded on the silver mines of Laurium. It was forbidden to work the silver mines with ordinary slaves because of the way that they just killed men. They were worked largely by war prisoners. Anyhow, so it then becomes just as easy for people to say, oh, classical Athens was horrible. It has nothing to teach us. We have to reject everything associated with it because it was just so bad, right? That's just the inversion of the myth of the Golden Age. That's saying that if something wasn't perfect, then we must reject it, right? If something has flaws, then there is nothing valuable in it at all. And then you keep on looking for the Golden Age, right? You keep on looking for the one place when everything was perfect. So 1940s America, where that refrigerator was manufactured, was not a golden age, but clearly it has something to teach us about appliances. 1960s and 70s, late 1960s, early 1970s United States, again, not a golden age, right? There was the Vietnam War. There was a social struggle about whether black people should be allowed to live on the same terms as white people. There was a social struggle about whether women should be allowed to have bank accounts in their own names. But on the other hand, late 1960s, early 1970s, the United States sent people to the moon, which has to be considered one of the high watermarks, one of the great accomplishments of humanity, not only of our own civilization, but of any civilization at any time. Don't succumb to the myth of the Golden Age, right? The myth of the Golden Age is easy, right? It's an easy intellectual shortcut. It's easy for the lazy, because it means that you don't have to apply much judgment and discernment. You can just idealize whatever culture it is, right? Whether it's classical Athens or late Showa period Japan, which, you know, I only mention because given all the Japanese animation laserdiscs that I have, you know, somebody might say, ah, well, you must be really, really, you must be a real true believer in late Showa period Japan. To which my answer is, I find it very interesting, but I don't cast it as golden because there are some really obvious flaws of that society. It's merely that, and this is a thing to think about when you're thinking about things like this, and yes, that's periphrastic at its best. It's very easy to see the good in another society where it contrasts with flaws that we are familiar with in our own society. It's much less easy to see problems that we are not familiar with because we haven't experienced anything like them. So that is the real, I think, crux of it. That if you use discernment, you can take lessons from many different kinds of societies. You can take lessons from many different historical eras. They all have something to teach. Almost all of them will have something worthy of imitation. And equally, all of them will have something worthy of being avoided and execrated. You know, this is, again, the danger, as I've mentioned before, of saying, well, you know, such and such is an indigenous cultural practice, so it's okay. And it's like, yeah, I hate to tell you this, but if you're talking about the Aztec human sacrifices, the army with which Cortez marched on Mexico City was something like 100,000 soldiers raised by the various states of what is now Mexico, who were not Aztecs and who were sick and tired of the Aztecs and their sacrifices and who wanted nothing more than to desecrate their temples, throw down their idols, and make their priests to pass under the yoke. They might not have wished to be forcibly converted to Christianity themselves, but they were certainly down for doing it to the Aztecs. Which, as a matter of fact, they were not forcibly converted to Christianity in the end. But that's another story for another day. Right. And equally, if you say, well, such and such is an indigenous cultural practice, therefore it's okay. Well, I mean, what is the difference between, let's say, the Inuit hunting whales and the Japanese hunting whales? You know, if you look at Japanese history and culture, you discover that A, with a strong Buddhistic influence, and B, with not much in the way of grazing land, right, they've never really eaten much red meat. And I found a mention that in, say, the 13th century, noblemen might go hunting in the mountains and capture a deer, and the meat was sometimes euphemistically referred to as mountain whale, which tells you that the fishermen of the coastal areas did, in fact, hunt whales from time to time. Now, in that sense, then, whale hunting is a traditional Japanese cultural practice, but people are appalled when the Japanese do it, so far as I can tell, simply because Japan is a modern industrial nation state, and as befits a modern industrial nation state, when Japanese fishermen today hunt whales, they hunt it from steel-built engine-propelled vessels rather than from kayaks covered in skin. And you may be wondering by now, what in the world is this side path that he's gone down? And again, I'm simply warning you against judging anything. See, this is two sides of a coin, and it's very difficult sometimes to properly articulate this. But it's often said that you can't judge something independently from its circumstances, from its social context, right? You can't judge behaviors or laws or customs, what have you, independently of the other circumstances, the methods of food production in a society, the methods and the form of land tenure in a society, for example, will always be closely connected, that sort of thing. And that's true. But on the other hand, it is equally dangerous to take those circumstances as the only basis for a judgment. Now, is that really a useful thing for me to say to you? I don't know. I was thinking the other day about this because there are some people, for example, who there's a school of, you might call them feminist anthropologists, who have come up with this lovely, but so far as we can tell, completely non-factual narrative about how, you know, where Europe was dominated by agrarian, vegetarian, matriarchal tribal societies until the evil Indo-Europeans with their ox herding swept in from the east, you know, 7,000 years ago or whatever. And again, don't try to create mentally a society which you think has all the features which you admire, and then locate it in some remote place or time. Right? This is utopianism. Utopianism at its finest, except that, of course, More's utopia was understood to be fictional, and equally was understood to be an ideal society, that is, not a real one, but one to think about, without the encrustation that the word ideal has obtained, in which it's used to mean something that is the best, right? The ideal doesn't have to be the best. The idea of Platonic forms, right, is that they are the perfect of which everything we see in our world is more or less imperfect expressions, but even so, philosophical idealism is another topic entirely, which I don't have the time or the energy to get into here. I just want to give you the thought that you can make up any kind of society, right? Any kind of historical milieu, anything like that. You can make it up in your mind, but made up in your mind is very, very difficult, very, very different from a society full of real people living in a real world where they have to eat, right? They have to cook their food and all those other things. Anyway, two other things that occupied my attention this past week. One of them, I saw a little squib of a news item about pedicabs in New York City and how, for some reason, they had an ordinance limiting to a total of 840, which is a strange number. And somebody was asking, well, why don't you just issue licenses? Why don't you sell licenses? And I thought, you know, this is a very interesting point. Because, now, the term pedicab is a foolish one. The proper term for this is rickshaw. Jinrikisha is a Japanese word meaning human-powered vehicle, and came into English in the 19th century. And the old-style rickshaw was a two-wheel cart with two long poles out in front, and a man would put the poles over his shoulders and run as fast as he ever could from where he started out to where you were going. But a bicycle rickshaw is still a jinrikisha, still a human-powered vehicle. And as you know, I usually object to the use of human labor as motive force. But the rickshaw is a special case. Why is it a special case? Well, it's a special case because, I mean, aside from the fact that bicycling is not a bad way of getting exercise, and exercise is a decent way to stay healthy, so the effect on the rickshaw driver is not all that bad, but it's a special case because, fundamentally, the purpose of the human in the loop is as the directing intelligence, right? This is true in a motor-powered taxicab as it is true in a rickshaw. But, and here is the point, that moving one person from place to place is, unless they have a whole lot of heavy baggage, and I admit to being guilty of this on occasion, unless they have a whole lot of heavy baggage, a real waste of the mass of the motor vehicle and the power of its engine. In other words, in a taxicab which is carrying one passenger, the mass of the driver and the passenger put together is perhaps 10% at most, maybe more like 5% of the whole mass of the cab. Whereas the mass of just the driver and the passenger is, in many places, I mean, depends on your local topography, obviously, but in many places, not that great that with a bicycle frame and a canopy over it and that kind of thing, which perhaps adds another 50% of weight, it's pretty convenient for a person's mechanical effort to be able to move around. And so the fact that you need the human as the directing intelligence, the fact that he's also doing the work of moving the thing, isn't something that I find objectionable in that sense. I know it seems like a strange comment from me. I will also say, however, that I've seen a lot of, in recent years, what I might call hybrid human-powered vehicles, in which there's also an electric motor and a battery pack to give assistance when the human is tired or can't quite develop enough force. And I see these things, for example, in postal delivery settings. Right. Where you have a bicycle messenger, in effect, who's delivering mail and parcels, and typically it's a large bicycle with a trailer on it. There are lots of bright yellow ones in Germany owned by Deutsche Post. And what really makes this interesting to me, I suppose, is that when you want to move a number of people, or people with impedimenta, but particularly when you want to move a number of people all going in the same, roughly the same direction at the same time, you know, I'm always going to advocate for electric vehicles in the form of street railways, right, running under overhead wire. Not as in they're promoting in Germany currently, these ghastly hydrogen tram, right? There was a place where they're talking about their brand new hydrogen tram, where, of course, it's running on tracks. There is overhead wire. There is no conceivable rationale for something which is limited by its own onboard energy conversion, right? Which is which is the situation here. There's no conceivable rationale for such a thing, except that people have this delusion about the hydrogen, the solar hydrogen economy. It does nothing but feed into that delusion. And I see that in California, for example, the legislature has passed a requirement that all public transit vehicles be zero emission by 2029. Well, of course, the obvious thing to do is start stringing up overhead wire, right? Run trolley buses where you can, run streetcars where you can, but there are no grants available for that. The transit systems don't have the money for that. There's only one thing that there are grants available for, and that's hydrogen buses. Why are there hydrogen buses available? Well, because this is California, and for all their prating about climate change mitigation and all their prating about zero emission this and that, the plain fact is that the oil industry still is enormously influential in California. And the oil industry knows perfectly well that they are, for the time being, the only feasible source of hydrogen for hydrogen-powered vehicles. And so they got the legislature to include lots and lots of grants, and so there's billions of dollars being given out for the purchase of hydrogen-powered transit vehicles, which are an essentially untried technology, certainly unproven technology, with very questionable prospects. Whereas the tried and true technology of overhead wire and the at least reasonably well-proven technology of overhead wire plus batteries for running in outlying areas where running overhead wire would be uneconomical or difficult, that technology, the technology which everyone knows works well, is simply not being implemented. So yes, I want you to think about why, as I often say, why is it that people who insist that climate change is the most urgent matter of our time also tend to seem to insist that only ineffective measures be taken to address it? Does that make any sense to you? It certainly doesn't to me. I will believe in decarbonizing transport when I see the overhead wires running up. I will believe that people are serious about decarbonizing the energy system when I see ground being broken for breeder reactor nuclear power plants. Until I see those things, I have deep suspicions of people who claim that those are their priorities. Now, I'm just going to mention here for a moment a thought that I had, which I will expand on later, about the so-called nuclear waste problem. Peter Beckman, I think it was, wrote a pamphlet entitled The Non-Problem of Nuclear Waste, but I was thinking about it. People say, oh, we can't leave this legacy for future generations. And that's very interesting because, of course, pretty much everything we do produces waste. And either there's a process which removes that waste or there isn't. So, for example, in the case of carbon dioxide dumped into the atmosphere, photosynthesis is the process that removes that waste gradually. But as we've seen, we can dump it faster than it can be removed. In the case of nuclear energy, that's not possible, because the process which removes the waste is inherent in the thing itself. In other words, fission products are hazardous toxic waste because they're radioactive. The fact that they're radioactive means that they are constantly diminishing in quantity. And here's the fun thing, as was pointed out by W. Bennett Lewis of AECL back in the early 70s. He got into a fight with Alvin Weinberg over it. The mathematical law which governs radioactive decay and the constants involved are such that in the particular case of the fission product waste of the nuclear fuel cycle, the quantity when a constant or increasing amount of nuclear power is being used, the quantity of waste older than 20 years, the total radioactivity in it, is no greater than the radioactivity in the waste that's newer than 20 years. In other words, it can't be left as a legacy for future generations, in the sense that a generation is generally taken as 20 years. Only twice 20 years waste ever exists at one time. How do you like that? Anyway, send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 103-5, Fort Worth, Texas 761.